activist show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So, irresistible eloquence opens portals between worlds. We welcome the 13th guesthood of Martine Prechtel, whose latest proffering be rescuing the light that we may snap out of it, he encourages, in far more eloquent language, and embrace our dangerous, beautiful assignment, composting trauma into the nutrient for our gift, as he has done. His website is floweringmountain.com. It is the dark of the moon before Friday evening's new moon in Cancer. 'Tis the time now when people traditionally gather to determine the course of culture. So I'm going to read Martine's self-description because it's notable for its colorful, concise complexity. I transcribed it from the Audible version of his book, Rescuing the Light, so I will say it less well than he did, but it's really great. Here we go. He says, an avid student of indigenous eloquence, innovative language, and thought, Martine Prechtel is a writer, artist, and teacher who, through his work, both written and spoken, hopes to promote the subtlety, irony, and pre-modern vitality hidden in any modern language. A half-blooded Native American with a Pueblo Indian upbringing, an Irish grandmother, I stuck that in, he left New Mexico to live in a village of Santiago Atitlan, Guatemala, eventually becoming a full member of the Mayan community there. For many years, he served as a principal in that body of village leaders, responsible for piloting the young people through rituals into adulthood. Once again, residing in his beloved New Mexico, teaching at his school, Bolad's Kitchen, I know many people there, through an immersion into the world's lost seeds and sacred farming, forgotten music, magical architecture, ancient textile making, metalsmithing, making and using of all sorts of tools, musical instruments, and food, and deeper meanings of origin of all things and the older stories and ancient texts. And by teaching through the traditional use of riddles, Prechtel hopes to inspire people of every mind and way to regrow and revitalize real culture and to find their own sense of place in the sacredness of a newly found daily existence in love with the natural world. And there he be, because Hannah gave me your birthday, there he be born on the waxing full moon in a moving car with a magic backpack comprised of myriad ancestral mentors guiding stories from human, plant, animal, and more that he would hone by worked adversity and grief into a prolific bloom for guiding our rude species, our rogue species, back to manners. Hence, participatory animism, never more welcome or relevant. And I'm just going to let Jornis, nature's evolutionary trickster genius, introduce you further. Its image right now be in the midst of a wild storm, a stranger walks into town wearing a silk top hat, carrying a large black bag. The doctor, magician, collaborator with nature. Welcome, Martine.
Hey, Caroline. A long time I haven't heard your voice.
No. And I was searching for the necklace that you bestowed upon me so long ago when I met you and beautiful Hannah. And I was rummaging. I put it in some sacred hidden place, but when I find it, we'll have to do a next show.
Sounds good. Yeah, I remember that necklace. Yeah, that was a good one.
That was a good one, and it was bestowed with full mojo. It was really important and good. And I think that was your last...
Yeah.
All-time necklace. It has everything on it. I know it's in an important place. It's being very tricky right now. But that was, I think, your last Great Mother Conference and my first. It was sort of like you were handing a baton.
Yeah I think that's true. I mean, I was handing you a necklace. It was a trick, you know, to make you take it. But anyway, it was great that you did. Thanks for all the people anyway. It was great. It was great for them, too. I left.
No. It was your escape. It was your escape necklace.
I taught you how to do it, so you can do it to the next one. You know.
Well, I've already escaped, right? Robert left, I also just want to do homage to your great ally Jake, right? Who set this up? Skookum, because he gave me an admonition. He said, Martine will not be interviewed by anyone who has not read every word of his book. I go, oh, okay. At first, I was a little grumpy, but I worked through it. Yeah.
Well, Well, Jake is a lovely guy. He's a treasure. I mean, he's the guy that administrates. I mean, he's kind of like my secretary. He's also Jewish, and so he's like this psychic butcher. And he's a farmer, and he does, you know, look, when any of my horses get out, we're out there with ropes. And then he's got all these hippies at the school, you know. It's unbelievable. But, yeah, he's kind of bossy sometimes. He kind of learned it from me, but it's awful nice of him to think that, because he really likes this book, so he wants everyone to love it, you know.
That's great. No, he was just transmitting your bossiness, but he was incredibly gracious in all of his...
Oh, good.
That was,
I'm glad to hear it.
Well, so... I did read every word, at first kind of like, oh, and then, oh, what a good idea. So I have your book heavily annotated, and as you know, you can go anywhere you like. But I did find in the journey of the book, because I listened to it and I read it, and again, you repeat things, which is wonderful. And I found the medicine there. You said you have within you the wherewithal to take one of your poisonous thoughts or curses and break it down. Learn the origin of the words, learn their real etymology, then reassemble differently into something worthy that now blesses what you were cursing. That's great.
Yeah, that's very good you picked that. Amazing. Well, first of all, I'm sure you know that these little tidbits are just tiny little bits of bigger things. And... there are also things that students over the years have thought that have held true to their hearts that they love so much. So I originally written a book just like this with what I wanted everybody to have in really tiny short form. And then I realized, no, I better have what really sticks in their craw, you know, and they take it home with them. So it's very interesting you picked this one up, because that's really one of the main things of Bullet Kitchen. I mean, only a couple of people really understand what that means, because, of course, can't really understand it until you've tried to do it, because it's not quite as straightforward as it looks, you know. But the thing is that with language, you know, I love language so much, but language can be also poisonous and so horrible and send people to their deaths and all sorts of ugly things. But it can also be just the most amazing, magical thing. And for natural peoples all over the world, you know, language is the most amazing thing. So when you start to use your language, you know, in your head, a lot of people, you know, like, they don't come from oral societies, but they have all this junk rattling around their head. They walk past, you know, I remember what it started up with was one of my students, long, long time ago, you know, 12, 15 years ago, was in our neighborhood and coming down, you know, to go to the school where we live and on our little ranch, and he was walking past some of my neighbor's places, and there were a lot of dead cars, you know, these old red cars from, you know, 20, 30, 70, 80 years, you know, when they first invented the damn things, all lined up, you know, dead with their hoods up and their, you know, doors open like they are on the Navajo Reds, you know. And started, you know, kind of making a very nasty joke, kind of racially biased against my Spanish-American neighbors. And so I thought, okay, here we go. So I said, do you know why they have those? Do you know what they do? I mean, the little kids all come out with the old people, and they sit in the car, and the great-great-great Eleanor, whose grandfather bought this car, and they wrecked it and died in it, and then the next guy buy a car, so they change cars, and they go sit in the next one. The whole history of their family is they sit in this car, and they go to the next car until, you know, they're into the, you know, the Mazda at the very end of the line that didn't run to begin with. And so it's like, it's a whole history of grief of their family. So I said, you've got to take the words that you had in your head that you said, which I'm not going to say on the air, because, of course, they find the meanings of these words. So I said, okay, first of all, you said something about Mexicans. What's the word Mexican mean? The word Mexican comes from the word Mexica. Mexica means cloud people in the central Nahuatl language. So and I said, then you use this word, and then you use this word, and then you use this word. Now take those words and look up and find out what they actually descend from. They have a descendancy. Everything has an ancestry. And then take those ancestries and rearrange them into cursed in your head. Now try doing that when you're not, you know, in front of a crowd, and you're not going to get applause for having done it. and do it with whatever or whoever or anything, you know, that you decide to poison with your thought. And you realize you can make those words, all these words that can kill, can be learned to blast, you know. It was an amazing thing to do, you know. Amazing thing to
right.
do.
Right.
I love that.
I really.
That was great. Yeah.
Right, and I left off the last crucial sentence that you just said. Whatever is used to curse can be taught to bless. There we go.
That's right.
That's really
That's
great.
Right. That's well, right. But well, you gotta, think about it. You know what does that mean?
Well,
and then the other thing is the young people who are sent to war. You know, I mean, most of them end up, you know, touching the other people with bullets or phosphorus bombs. But the truth of the matter is, what is being manipulated is their desire to touch something besides what the bad apple pie they've been eating their whole life. So everything can be taught to bless.
Right. Again, as you say, you know, we cook everything back to its originating liberating impulse before it was bamboozled, hoodwinked, you know, imperialized, inquisitioned, whatever. What did it want to be? But I do want to ovify to the magic of your book, because you know, when I started off, I guess at my own grumpy mood, I was sort of arguing with parts of the book, going and then I went back and I go, oh no, it's good. I'm liberated from my harumphitude. There we go. I like it. Oh, it's all good. There we go. So yeah. So the book itself, just reading it, does compost our poisonous thoughts and break them down, and
go
you know, and then learn to bless. So that's wonderful. And wonder. And I did, you know, you said admire means to look at, and it does, and it also means regard with wonder. So admire is the
right.
is the consort of wonder, which is wonderful.
That's right. Absolutely. Admire. Yeah, admire. Well, the people, you know, they lose their sense of wonder so easily when they're being sold a lot of things, that, and if they've been there, done that, and then the sun coming up is nothing to them anymore, instead of they're surrounded by the most amazing, amazing things. And it's not the things that give you the feeling, it's your capacity to see them, you know. So that's what is those sayings. They're not, you know, any sort of remedy or anything like that. They're just friends. They're a companion to keep you from drowning in a lack of sense of wonder until you can get to some shores of hope, you know. I mean, this is certainly not a book of that's going to cure anything, but it's a thing that will keep people from drowning in their own stuff, you know. So that's what it's for, you know. I mean, it's kind of embarrassing, actually, because of all our kitchen students are all going, oh, Jesus, you know, we've been studying these deep, long things, and he puts these little, you know, tips of the iceberg stuff in the book, you know, and gives it to everybody. Oh, my God, you know, so it's kind of humorous, but. I thought, no, man, you know, like last year, the publisher, which is right there in Marin, you know, they were asking me, you know, what I wanted to do, because we were all getting together with some of the other authors to go try to get, you know, audiobooks, because I never would do audiobooks. But I thought, you know, all these shut-ins, all these guys under restriction and people in lockdown, some don't read, you know, and some do read and some can't read with that, you know, they're sick as they are. I said, well, let's just give them stuff. You know, so we gave away a lot of books and audio and made them happen. And then I said, I'm going to make this one, whether anybody likes it in the school or not, because I want them to have at least something to hold on to, you know. So that's what
but, you know,
it was. It's not really a book when you get down to it, but, you know. It's just
the art of aphorism, saying a lot and a little, is what these are.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You have many kin. Yeah, a friend of the show, Yahya Lababidi, is Egyptian aphorism artist. We love, they're tasty, but deep.
Yeah,
you know.
And I
wanted to just honor also, just from gazing at your chart and knowing you a smidge, and then ever more perhaps. But you know, to have a sharp tongue. I want to go to some spicy things that you say that are really good, but a sharp tongue wedded to a kind heart, right? Sharp tongue with a. You know, and I don't know if you know the etymology of charisma, but
sure.
It's really fun. Oh, good. It comes from charis, from which we get charitable. So true charisma is a charitable heart. Yeah.
Right. Truly, truly, truly. May it spread.
So, So I have a bunch of fun, sharp things you say with a kind heart. I have things. Well, I did take everything to heart, which you say, you forget things when you write them down. At least if you're going to write them down, say them out loud. So I did. And that's a good idea.
Well, it's not mine, but it's a good idea. You know that in the old days, they had a personage who was called an achzeb, which means a person who paints or writes and makes things smile. And that's what the people who wrote the hieroglyphics were. And then they had a guy who was called the Ahuchang. And the Ahuchang was the one that spoke those words out every year. They were required to be spoken. Everything that was ever written had to be spoken every year, at least once or four times, or the word would toxify and eat the writer and kill the culture. So they had an actual position in the village that had to speak every known written word that had ever been written, whether it was relevant or not, out loud.
So can I offer you back one of your spicy things about generosity? I'll say it and then you go with it, whatever. But I like this because it's a kind of admonishment, but in a spicy, liberating way. When you sneak around and try to get away with your life, you lose your soul. Then your body just becomes a shuttle bus for the ghosts of other stingy people who did the same thing.
It's easy going compared to what I wanted to say, but
we can go there. There's just four words you can't say on the air. We have to fill out forms,
that's right.
Right, but I also loved, I love what you say about loneliness and depression. So you said loneliness is the greatest driving force of cowardice. It takes courage to do something worthy all alone with no applause. I love that.
Yes, it's true. I mean, what more could you say? I mean, loneliness is a very hard thing to bear, but that's the basic, ingredient of initiation. In other words, when you're living in a tribal or a village situation, which is a little bit more, together and everything, that point that where you have to go do something alone to take the courage to do it is amazing. But cowardice is not entirely the lack of courage. It's also a type of what you might call institutionalized laziness. That, I have another one that says in there that complacency is basically, hatred on sedatives. And, it's a little bit more pointed. But the thing about cowardice is that cowardice is what makes war, and cowardice is what makes hatred. Bravery doesn't make war. Courage doesn't make war. So this is a very cowardly culture we're living in at this time. There are brave people, and there are tremendously courageous individuals, and even groups of people, don't get me wrong, absolutely. But as a general trend, in order to have business working as it should work, according to the way they want it to work, with scarcity, people have to be scared, and then they become cowards. And they do what they think they're supposed to do to get where they need to go, and they don't have the courage. Of course, how do you not be a coward? I mean, everyone is at some point or other a coward. But it's a cowardly culture. It really is. It's not enough powerfully generous, and not powerfully in love with being alive to the point to where it would die, instead of selling out. So
right, and I love availing myself to the dark humor of astrology in its deepest form, because it says depression still too shallow. Go deeper, right? That dedication, this is very much at the heart of your work, dedication is the antidote to depression. It's like, go deeper. It's still, depression's still very surface, right?
There are people that have a tremendous different kinds of depression, but the idea of depression being very convenient, versus happiness is not convenient,
Meaning what? Why is happiness is not convenient? Meaning what?
Well, I mean, you got to work hard. What's the old Yiddish saying? You got to be happy whether you're happy or not, because you know, that's that old Yiddish lady say, I'm sure you've heard it.
Yes.
Is that it's hard work to be a human being, and happiness and beauty, admiration, all that, is actually, it takes some work, it takes some labor, and it's not convenient, it's not efficient. Yeah.
And actually, that phrase, it was an older woman on Groucho Marx, and who was just full of delight. And he said, you're old and you're so full of delight, you must have the secret of happiness. And then she said, I realized there's no such thing as happiness, and you just have to be happy without it. Anyway, so there we go.
You have to be happy without
attributed.
It. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right.
So,
actually, you got it from somewhere else, but that's another point altogether. But at least somebody else told me that.
Well, it was an old woman on Groucho. That's how it came to me. But then I'll just stick these aphorisms of yourself in. You know, we all need to have at least a little rational thinking, but we must remember it's only the secretary of the ecstatic soul.
There you go. Right. Yeah. I think that's
true. Fun.
Well, humans, they're not rational. You know, the whole idea of humans being a rational being is a really irrational thought. I mean, that's crazy. But we're ecstatic beings, man, I think. You know, at least that's what I'm hoping for and I'm praying for and working toward. But ecstatic being, you know, I still need someone like Jake, you know, to, you know, get all the cows in the corral, man. You know, like everything what's got to be. So, you know, all these things are there for a reason. I mean, it's like, have you ever seen a raccoon? They wash all their food, you know, before they eat it. And yet they're kind of ecstatic little creatures, you know. So, there's, you know, you've got to have that some form. Do you remember that guy, Thelonious Monk? The jazz,
sure, he's
jazz
born singer. On my birthday.
One time, and he said to me, he said, you know what? Somebody's got to be playing the melody for everybody else to stretch out. And if there's not somebody playing the melody, man, everything's just stretching out and there's nothing there. And that's right. You know, there's got to be somebody still playing the song, the rational part, so that all of this creativity has a canvas to paint itself on, you know. So, I always
yes,
like
you
that.
Are. You have magnetized a splendid support team, and we wave to Hannah and Jake, and teammates Marianne Lust and Deborah Lubar. I listened to every single thing as well as read the book, you know, including your acknowledgments at the end, which were fulsome and wonderful, because it was like teammates going, "Hi there, oh great team." So just to tease it, you know, into now, you know, when you say. Anything that is learned fast is forgotten fast, and hence dogma, right? And when we look at the delusion in the world and the, you know, QAnon thing and I mean, all those kinds of things, it arises from that which we believe but have not earned. I think that's really the thing. Oh, and then let me hand it to you, too, because you say this spicy, fun thing, I don't know, I can't remember where it is, about purity as fascism.
It's under purity. Yeah, purity is fascism. We'll have to look it up, otherwise I'll misquote myself and I'll go off on a
tangent. I've got it. I'll rummage. It's right behind courtship. That's right. I've got it somewhere. All right. Because because you say that then, and it is better. Yes, courtesy is the courage not to be mean. I'm rifling through. Oh, wait, I have it. I have it. It's on page 198. I read every word. I feel like I'm doing homework. Right, and then we want to get to depression again, just for fun. And water. Here it is. Purity is the most demonic thing. It is the first cousin to oneness. And oneness is a declawed word for fascism. Fascism demands purity and a single direction. See, I think that's fun.
Yeah, it's getting me into a lot of trouble in the dojo, you know. But the idea of purity, you know, I mean, there's no such thing. You know, I mean, purity, everything's got to be mixed and crossbreeding and hybridizing and of all different colors. I have another place where I call it Iowa chili or Yankee gumbo, you know, because it's got no spices, man. It's got none of the cool stuff, you know. But the thing about fascism, like we're really dealing with right now in all forms, left and right, is that it demands, you know, all is one, but all is not one. Right. All is many, man. And to have only a single direction or a single origin or a single story or a single religion. No, man, that's right. The lemmings over the cliff. So purity is a very demonic thing. Clarity, cleaning stuff up, you know, making things good the best as you can, that's great. But purity is just, I got another saying here. It says, everything is always a mixed form and should be a mixed form. And when it stops being so, it truly dies in the unviable frailty of its continued purity. And that's same saying the same thing, exactly. But in looking at it from the opposite side. And so as all of these spiritualities and things, okay, we're looking for all is one. Let's unite. Okay, uniting is good, but it doesn't mean you lose your identity by getting together with somebody else. In other words, we have to have everybody and every kind all together. But it doesn't mean they have to stay together, and it doesn't mean they have to have only one way of thinking, you know, or one motion, or one way of looking, or one type of breath form, or one type of tooth form, or one kind of speech. And so I just think everybody's diverse speeches and the way they talk and look, and oh man, it's so deliciously beautiful. And everything on the earth is like that. As soon as you don't have that, it's GMO. It's GMO culture, you know. GMO plants, GMO people. So not good. Not happy, too. You know.
Right. Yes.
Beauty does not come from purity.
No, and where I find that a fun part of the brew, the spices, is, you know, just wondering, you know, how did a considerable proportion of our fellow citizens in the world become susceptible to the delusion virus? Oh. And it's like dogma, yeah. If you, and the whole yoga astrology world is, you know, I've been susceptible to this virus. And I go, again, dogma, when you believe something you haven't earned, and exactly what you said, only one story will get us into righteous fundamentalism, right? There you go.
Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. Under all conditions, and most people are thinking, you know, righteous fundamentalism is being, you know, Islamic or Jewish or Christian, but no, it runs on every level of everything, everywhere. And so the one story thing, with Native people where I grew up, you know, you have, right now among a lot of Natives, they're trying to find their one origin story and their one bloodline. This is very destructive to their tribe, because naturally speaking, among the real knowers in the old days and the people who know the story, they say, well, we don't know the whole story because the other half of the story is owned by the gods. We don't have it. They have it. The half that we have is only 49%, but there's this 1% that's always unfolding that neither they have or we have. And so when we put the two halves together, we get this butterfly with the middle of something that's unfolding today. So what was and what could be mixes together in the middle place. So when you're trying to get a oneness to something, this is a neurosis. I mean, it comes from a fear and a scaredness of wanting to have, you know, the original ancestor, or the original this, or the original substance, or the original that. And that's very toxic to the deliciousness of what it means to be truly alive on this earth, no matter whether you're a person or an animal or a plant, you know, because you can't have like one thing. If you have just that one ancestral thing, pretty soon you're going to atrophy, you know, it's going to fall apart. That's what happens to like breed standards with animals, you know, or horses or anything, where they say, okay, this is what this horse looks like, but yeah, then they try to make the horse fit to it, just like they make ladies try to fit the form of what they think a lady's supposed to look like, instead of saying, let's define the ladies by the way they look, you know, instead of defining them by what they're supposed to look like, you know. So you got this one size fits all mentality, which is, you know, comes from the neurosis of being terrified. But that's why it takes courage not to be a coward, you know.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a great thing. That's wonderful, Lily Yeh, who was taking on a daunting assignment to find beauty in the world and draw it forth, and said she was frightened, but she said she made herself frightened of being a coward. You know, because she said, if you, there was some part of her inside that said, if you don't do this, the most important part of yourself will die. So I made myself frightened of being a coward. Yeah, that was really great.
Perfect.
So,
okay.
So we're going to have a very, very short, very cute little musical break here. Our guest today is wonderful Martine Prechtel. His website is floweringmountain.com. Many ways to play, many books, many things. His latest book, Rescuing the Light, is on Audible, and it's good. You do Audible great, Martine, and also by our friends at North Atlantic Publishing, bless their hearts. And so we will be back after this very short break music, which I find adorable. It's just a smidge of this song about the Cheshire Kitten by S.J. Tucker. And here we go.
I grew up seeing things a little differently, appearing, disappearing, hardly innocent, nor tied down to the ground. I learned to roll and tumble with the punches, glory in my stripes and spots, walk by invisible and never make a sound. But heavy is the crown that's always hidden, tender is the heart you never see. Hard and fast shines the grin that we flash, but there's a vulnerable stripe or two on me. Maybe any place outside of Wonderland is not for me, my friend. If I leave my grin behind, remind me that we're all mad here, and it's okay. Sun up, sun down, the shadows hide me down in Wonderland, Wonderland. Nobody knows the way, but if you find it in your dreams, you can find it at your day job somewhere south of hell. Got to guide you. The story is not for anyone else to tell. Go down the rabbit hole and out the other side. You can't go home in the middle of the magic carpet ride. You gotta greet the sun before his lovely daughter moon. You can't forsake the journey for the safety of your room until you learn your lesson well.
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context. That was a smidgen of a very charming song called Cheshire Kitten by S.J. Tucker. Our more than perfect guest for now and all time is Martine Prechtel. It's his 13th time, but I think I haven't spoken to you in maybe a decade.
I think it's a little less than a decade, but it's been about 5 or 6 years, I think. But that's
something like
a long
that.
Time.
Yeah. But I got to tell you a fabulousness about your writing and the news. So you write, Native people sing sacred songs, not for entertainment. There was this wonderful news story. It was put out by the PR of the Saskatchewan police, and they said that they'd been. Do you know this? They were trying to. There was a man about to commit suicide and jump off a bridge, and there was White Buffalo, a Native American group that was drumming, and the man on the bridge said, "You know, the only thing that draws me back to life is their drumming and singing." So the police went over to the Native American band and said, "There's a man about to kill himself, and only your music can save him." And they said, "Sure, we're on it." Right.
That's absolutely right. I love that. I did hear that, but that's fantastic. I love that. Yeah. Music,
right.
Man.
So,
singing, all these things cure. You know? They do cure.
Well, and also it's one of your things, you know, that I also aspire, you know, going, you know, what we're doing anywhere, you know, it's not performance, it's magic. You know?
Right.
And magic.
Say that again, please.
It's not performance, it's magic. I say that before everything, you know, I do, every personal session or whatever, to remind myself, going, no little pirouettes about how clever one was. No, stop it, Caroline. There you go. No, it's not performance, right? We're composting performance, and you have a lot to say about that. That you say, they say magic is something people rely on when they don't know the truth. No, says Martine, science is what people rely on when they don't have any magic.
Well, you can have science and magic too, but that's what happens, you know. You're right there. Absolutely.
Yeah.
The performance thing is very problematic. It's like when I have my little school, you know, because when it starts up here again, and I've been doing a responding course, an actual writing course with all these beautiful people. I can't believe it. There's 400 people writing me letters, and I'm writing back to them every week. But there's no performing. We don't perform. You know, we're not getting on the stage, and there's no, you know, script or anything like that. It's the actual spiritual thing. And so when you're talking about the singing and all that, I mean, it's medicine. And it's not the sound only of it, and it's not what I feel about it that matters. It's got its own God and its own spirit and its own ability, and it goes moving. And this plants, animal, everything has a song. Every rock has a song. Every piece of dirt has a song. It's just we don't know them all. And we are made of all those pieces of rock and all of those pieces of dirt and all those pieces of trees and plants and animals and winds and weather and all those things. And so when we start to lose that and everything becomes a performance, then we kind of get what you call a spiritual autoimmune system, you know, and syndrome. And so that's a very problematic. So the performance thing, like, I'm not against people who perform, don't get me wrong, any more than I'm against people who paint paintings because people can go buy them in the art gallery. But when it comes to spiritual things, you can't perform a ceremony. Ceremonies are not performed. They're carried out, you know, and carried forth. So, yeah, that's really good that you brought that up. I mean, I harp on it, obviously, a lot. And people don't usually understand why I'm so heavy about that. But once you get to a certain point, you realize that most of the time when people are doing performances, the people are trying to release energy, trying to escape, instead of pressure cook the beauty inside their soul by not doing that, you see.
Right. And, you know, it's also, you know, in we all get to see Venus and Mars in loving embrace after sunset on a clear night in Leo. Right on top of your Venus and Pluto in Leo, your death and resurrection show, your sharp tongue with a kind heart. And it is, you know, it is the... I'm sorry, say what?
Sorry. You're the first person I've said I had a sharp tongue. I love it, though. That's great. My mother
really?
Was
no, that
I
can't
got,
be
I
true.
Got
you must have frightened them into not saying that.
I frightened a lot of people, but no one's ever had the guts to tell me I had a sharp tongue. But I do have a sharp tongue.
But wedded to a kind heart makes it really fun. That's the crucial part.
Yes,
right?
I love it. Yeah, I'm sorry. I just got a kick out of it.
No, that's great. That's great. Okay, I want to go back to depression because it's fun. Because what you write is liberating. You say the modern world has so much comfort. This is depression's little nest. That's fun.
Yes, it is.
It's kind of a sharp book. Yeah.
Well, it's very convenient to be depressed in the modern world. I mean, as a matter of fact, it's like almost a necessity. If you want to get a job, you have to have be depressed. You know, you can't do anything. If you're happy. You're out of the scene, man. You can't even get in the art world once. You know, you have to be depressed, man.
So, well, I think that might be... Well, I think, you know, alienation was... Well, alienation and melancholy once fashionable, but we don't have time for it, you know.
We don't have time anymore. I said that over here. Actually, well, I got a saying like that. It does. It's a, oh, wait, I might have taken it out, actually. Oh, yes, okay, well... Oh, yeah, here we go. At the same page. At this point, the stakes are very high. Let's get to work.
Yes.
You don't have time to be depressed. That's something you can put off to later. That's a misquote. Because what originally said, and they sanitized it, my nice little students, is that's something you can put off till you're dead, is what it really said, and my sharp tongue. But at this point, the stakes are very high. Let's get to work. You don't have time to be depressed. That's something you put off till later.
No, I like your version. That's something you can put off till you're dead. I'm changing it right here because I did extract that. Well, it's also, you know, as you say, you know, well, it's like it in the again astro fun biz, you know, Neptunian types, you know, melancholy. I like to say to myself and others, you know, the medievals thought melancholy was a sign of genius, but you don't need much. Just a little bit, right, to make you a genius, and then compost the rest of it.
Very good. Pounding the table.
So you say depression is convenient, economically viable, lazy and efficient. Feeding the holy is inefficient, not convenient, costs money, and takes a lot of effort. So, yeah, I like that. But how does feeding the holy take a lot of money? Uh-oh. Have we lost him on that question? Come back. Oh.
Hello?
Oh. Hello.
Can you hear me?
Oh, you're back now. Yes, now I can hear you.
You. Can you? Okay, good.
Yes.
It doesn't take a lot of money. It just takes a lot of the time that you would be spent making money. You see, in other words, it takes away from your money. So, you see, like, all the Christians, they have a big problem with money and God. Whereas, you know, like, natives, they don't get any problem with that because firewood, money, horses, it's all the same thing. There's no difference. It's not, you know, it's not an abstract investment thing. So, the point is that Feeding the holy is extremely expensive. It doesn't take a lot of money. It takes most of your life. And so you're not going to get rich if you're feeding the holy. That's an old Navajo saying like that, actually. I spend all my time feeding the spirit, so I'll never get rich. I have too many relatives who are sick. I've got to make all these ceremonies. So,
well, that's great.
You know, it's not efficient. God is not efficient. All that's been invented so people can get past nature. You know, to taste the holy.
Right. So I would just want to edit that for your next edition. Feeding the holy is inefficient, not convenient, costs money. Costs you the time that you would be making money. I like the money in there
because it irritates people because they don't want to spend any money on the holy. Of course, that means they think if I spend money, I'm going to get to the holy. I know. I understand what you're saying. But I like all of it. It's always going to be missing.
No, I like all of it.
I have a quote about that, too.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Under words. You can't really get anything across with words, you know. Anyway, no, that's all right. Yeah, the depression, where was it? Feeding the holy is inefficient, not convenient. It costs money, costs time, it costs effort. But a lot of people want that to take that out. In other words, if there's no money involved, if there's no effort, then there's no effort. In other words, worth is only money with the modern people. So it's not true. But it is, the point is that it's expensive. It's expensive to be feeding the holy. And
that's
it should be expensive. It should be 51% of your national income. Yeah.
Okay. And I just want to, just for the fun of it, toss in, you know, your ancestor colleague, Alan Watts, who said, the problem with Western man and Christianity is that they sucked the finger instead of going where it pointed. Very nice.
I remember Alan Watts. He came to our house twice, you know, with my dad. Oh. You knew him. Yeah, I used to sit under, I was really young, I used to sit under the table. I mostly saw his shoes and his vodka bottle. But he was, he had some great stuff to say. That's beautiful, wonderful. I never heard that one.
He did. Wait a minute, I'm dancing around here. But we've handled depression. That's good.
I don't know.
But then you say this fat. No, I'm quipping. I'm quipping. But then I was listening last night and then reading it simultaneously. But you say this really intriguing thing. Wait a minute, where am I? About gambling. I would love. I mean, I have it here. I have it here if you want. But if you say, you know, gambling should not be for winning or speculation for gain. For Native people, spiritual gambling is designed specifically for ritual loss.
Right.
When you gamble to win, it causes war. Casino gambling is all war and sickness. And then you go on if you want to say more about that. But I love that distinction because the Mayan, the Popol Vuh, right? I mean, it's the twins are gambling, right?
Yeah, between them and the... Well, the thing in the Popol Vuh, it's not gambling at all. Actually, it's divination. But, you know, it comes down to the same thing, you see. The thing is that gambling, one of the things that modern people are really having problem with is chance. You know, who gets sick, who doesn't get sick, who dies, who doesn't die. You know, somebody does everything you're supposed to do and they die anyway. Somebody doesn't pay any attention to anything and nothing ever happens to them. But that's because they think that dying is some kind of punishment or that being knocked back in the ground and turning into a seed and growing a new world is somehow lesser than making it to the top of a corporate ladder and being in your little fortress and blasting off to plant potatoes on Mars. But the point is that when you're... chance is there because it's the possibility of something happening wonderfully. Because it's not going to happen because people do it. It's going to happen because the divine has it. And the divine will doesn't come from God saying, I want this to happen. No, it only happens by chance because God obeys chance too. Okay, so does nature. So when with natural peoples throughout the world, gambling was always there, and it's still there, by the way. I don't know what it was. Stuff is nonsense. And many places in the world, Africa as well, parts of Africa and West Africa especially, where everybody plays against one another to gamble off all of the belongings of a person who's passed away, all of their land, all of everything. Otherwise, what happens is the people start coveting all of the stuff that the dead person had, like the breaking, you know, how people, when they read a will or something, they start fighting over all this stuff. And this way, what happens is the dead person gets to play with you, too, and gets to have the roll of the dice to see who gets what. So basically, the idea is that the person who's deceased is the one who's choosing who gets to keep what and where it goes. Oh. And so chance is the thing that distributes all of the things so that grief can turn into beauty, which makes a hollow place. Because, like, what a lot of Americans don't understand, you know, when they started beating up all of the Native Americans, and especially on the east coast of this country, was that all the wars that happened after the, you know, these characters from Europe landed, because the Europeans used to do this too a long, long, long time ago, but, you know, they didn't by the time they got here. And what was going on was the Indians would make these raids into settlements in order to get captives to replace the people that had been killed by smallpox, or to replace the people that had been killed in the warfare with the Europeans. And they weren't trying to kill the enemy. They were trying to get young people in order to replace the dead person. And so the gambling that went on before these kind of raids would take place was to make the room so that the dead person's memory was now a throne, so that the new person could sit in there. And so you have this new adopted person who was actually from the tribe of the people that killed the other guy. And so now your enemy became your son or your daughter or your brother or your sister or your mother or your father. You see? And so gambling was the way that was assigned, because they didn't just like say, okay, I'll take that guy. You know, they would do it. You know, there's different methods of doing it. I won't go into that right now with the basket game and all that. But it was very amazing. And it was all about grief. It was all about making sure grief didn't turn into violence inside the village too, because what happens is it always turns to violence, even if it's, you know, internalized as depression, however you want to look at that. But, you know, it's kind of a big subject to be going on in a short program. But anyway, yeah, the chance, and so gambling, you know, of course, is the most what you might say outright form of you say chance, but it really, when it comes down to it, it's a form of divination. It's not about loss and gain, it's about distribution. Yeah.
That's great. I want to do a lightweight quip and then go back to your deeper self. But a friend of mine, when I was a little girl, but he was a radical professor at Harvard Law School, and he said, anytime a great fortune dies, you should just spin a wheel, going, yes, you at Frank's Dry Cleaners, you are now inheriting the Dow fortune. You
know, and I'm totally for that.
Yeah, I think it's fun.
But it's the same thing. Same thing.
Yeah, well, and then the liberated dead person would be picking, you know, Frank's Deli, or the Amazon workers in Georgia. Here's the entire Koch brothers' fortune to you.
I think that would be fun.
So, right, and then you mentioned the magic word divination, and we are in great accord, because in this, you know, and loving the craft of astrology, right, and in the pandemic, you know, the question, what's going
to
happen is... What? Oops, we're talking over each other because there's a delay. Sorry, what were you saying?
I was saying that the person who came to become who passed away, that then is actually eaten into the village. Basically speaking, every individual absorbs this person. So the next baby that is born is the person who just died, and his replacement there takes on his space. So there's never any diminishing of population, and so the idea of losing and winning among people when it comes to natural death, when it comes to epidemics, when it comes to pandemics, the people are still trying to fight a war to go get somewhere, not here. And I think it's really strange that, or really appropriate that, you know, Jeff Bezos and all these guys are trying to blast out of the earth to go to some other place instead of learn how to live here well, because that's exactly, they're trying to outdo chance and outdo everything. But what they forgot is that the universe, you know, your beautiful stars and everything, are nature, are part, it's not like they're part of it, they are it, you know. It's like the earth is just a diatom in the scheme of things, you know. It's like, hey guys, wake up, man, that's so weird. But yeah, chance is is one of the most amazing things of all, and so hard for, I don't know what to call it, I don't, modern is not really the right word, civilized people, but people who live in this condition of monetized culture that we are in, because it's just, to them, you know, some go good and some don't, but who gets the luck and who doesn't get the luck? Well, what luck? I mean, you're lucky to be alive. You're lucky that all this ash and this water forms together so Caroline and me can talk together on a crazy electron device and make jokes and live for an extra little time and drink some tea. And I mean, whoa, this is more than I thought life could ever be. And but no, it's never good enough, you know. And so
no, but
chances
but you say
that distribute.
So you say, I never knew there was certainty. Maybe something good will happen.
Yes, exactly.
I think that's charming. I think that's very charming. Yeah, certainty always a booby prize. And a prison, really. Certainty is a false prison. And now there is no certainty.
never
nor
happened.
Nor any nor no normal either. I mean, so that's really
well, there great. Never was. I don't know what everybody's talking
right.
about. Everyone's so depressed. I'm like, okay, I know you were depressed to begin with, but now you're like depressed for real because you're realizing that it was what somebody always told you it was. I mean, like, oh, no, come on. The sun is still coming up, and, you know, you can still grow some corn, man. And, you know, the love between people can be even more great now than it ever was, you know, if they wanted
so
it
I
to
have,
be.
I have another sharp-tongued thing that you said that's fun. You said, I have to scare you a little bit because the comfort you live in is too scary for me.
That's the truth. There's nothing more I can say about that.
That's really great.
These people terrify me, man. They sit there, you know, oh, so comfortable. I mean, oh, God, I'm not going to go. I'm going to sound like a 10,000-year-old man. When I was young, you know, we had to do that. You guys don't even
You had to walk to school in the snow, right? Right
walk
but,
to school.
But,
I lived at the school. I tried to do everything I could do to get away from it. But, yeah. But, yeah, no, I mean, we were thrown from horses and run over by this and shot at by these things and did this, that, and the other, and half our friends died from this sickness and that, which is another thing nobody realizes, you know, is that there's been so many illnesses, so many plagues, so many epidemics that no one paid any attention to until it was affecting the major, you know, sovereign culture. And, I mean, I could go on. I'm sure you've heard the numbers before, but the town I live in here, we live in with my family, at this point in this valley of 15 miles, has about 900 people in it, which is way bigger than it was the last time I talked to you. It was 180 then. But in 1960s, there wasn't even, I think, 70 people here. And that's because they'd all been wiped out by tuberculosis, because the East Coast doctors had sent, you know, D.H. Lawrence and all these other guys to New Mexico in order to recuperate from tuberculosis, which created an enormous epidemic here and actually killed 30-40% of the local population, because most of them had Indian blood, and well, they still do, and whether they're Spanish Americans or whether they were actually natives. And it was just ghost town after ghost town. When I was growing up, I didn't know New Mexico wasn't just a bunch of towns with no people in it. But that's what happened. And now, you know, it's kind of bounced back, and people have come back in, and people from other places have come. But no one paid attention to it. You know, nothing. I mean, it was, you know, it's not even in the history books, hardly. I mean, a little bit. But, you know, not to diminish in any way the sufferings of the people today with COVID-19 and so forth. I'm just saying that, oh, God, where did this come from? I said, what are you talking about? You know, these sort of things have been around forever and ever, and there always will be. And the farther people get away from the ground, the more and more they're going to be. So that's the way it is. You have to live.
Let's speak of, again, these small snippets of what you tease in your life and your work and your book, Rescuing the Light, you know, into larger things. But, you know, you speak in praise of flair and style and dressing up as an honoring of the divine. Do you want to say more? Because that's
well, dressing
fun.
Up, I hope that I saw that in there, the way I put it. When I say dress up, I don't mean, you know, like going and buying style clothing or what people are calling dressing up now. It means like tribally dressing deliciously. and beautifully. I used to live in tribes for a long time when I was little, and then when I was in my 30s, my 20s and 30s, and you would sometimes see a group of ladies, for instance, like in Atitlan, there would be two little ladies who were born as dwarfs, and they were dressed, you know, to the teeth, like all young Indian ladies like today. They would have their 16-year-old friends who were, you know, regular-sized girls, dressed to the teeth, and there were a couple of matrons, you know, up in their 50s and 60s and 70s, dressed to the teeth. And they would have one relative there who didn't have very much to their name, and they were pretty much an orphan. They would take them to their hut, dress them up best clothes that the people had, and they'll go back out on the street just to walk. They weren't like washing clothes. They just to walk, because you had to be beautiful, because that's what fed the holy. And the young men were the same way. You got to remember, I was, you know, Anglo-looking half-breed kind of guy, and I was like, you know, a whole foot and a half taller than anybody else in the town except Chivalio for some reason. And when I would go on the street, well, you know, I didn't have good clothes. And these guys, they would pull me into their huts, and they would dress me up to the teeth and pull me around. And there was one little kid, he wasn't little, but he was a young guy. He was blind, and he had been born with only one leg. And so, you know, he wasn't really good at walking. So they would carry him between two boys so that they could all go walking together, you know. But this guy could swim like a seal, man. You throw him in the lake and he could go, you know, 2 miles and come back just like an otter. He was unbelievably, I mean, swift. He was obviously an animal, you know. And he was happy. And so whenever the kids would go out to what they call Narawak, and you go around and, you know, they just go walking and being beautiful. There was a time of day when everybody went and walked and be beautiful. And so this guy didn't have, you know, too much clothes, and plus he have only one leg. The lady have to weave for that. So these guys would concoct all kind of really good and beautiful clothing for him, and his sash would shine, and his beautiful shirt would shine, and get him a really good hat and cock it to the side, and they walk with him so proud, you know, their best friend with one leg, and to make sure so that they weren't going to say, okay, we're just going to say in his decrepit state, he is, you know, okay with us. No, we're going to make him better than us, and we're going to take him, and we're going to go, and none of us are going to be less. None of these people had a bank account.
We're on our way out, Martin. We're on our way out, Martin.
I know.
But we're
going
to have to.
You got me going now. You got me going.
No, what?
I'm just getting started.
When I find the necklace, we're going to do your book about horses. And courtesy is the courage not to be mean.
I have to slip
this in. You know, what passes for courtship in America is, look, I made this golden statue of myself for you. Anyway, we're going to keep it rolling. yes, whatever, all wondrous worthy seeds to plant. Thank you so much, Martin Brechtel and Kirsten
all
Thomas,
right.
Wonderful
blessing.
Board up. I'm
all
Caroline
blessing.
Casey, we're on our way out. Woof, 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 woof.
Right.
Coyote Network News.
Bueno. Big time.